My name is Jerry Aker. The title of this session is that I picked is Prospectives on Central America. It falls as the first session in a series of about 9 or 10 that I will be working with for the next 2 weeks. And give an outline here. The overall kind of theme that I'd like to work on is toward understanding of Central America. And that would be raising our awareness of the region and the problems, and kind of clarifying, but particularly focusing on that word awareness, which I want to pick up on again in a minute. Perspectives on Central America tonight. Tomorrow, I want to go into some more background, give you information. We'll talk about the background in several of the countries. The next day, I'd like to talk about a particular experience of one of the churches in Central America, the Guatemalan church. And we're going to focus on the church under persecution, looking at the experience, the recent experience of the Guatemala church, particularly the Catholic church. On Thursday, Experiencing Liberation Theology, it's an approach to giving us an understanding of Bible study from the perspective of liberation theology. And on Friday of this week, which is as far as we've gone as far in scheduling, will be Nicaragua, Some Personal Reflections. My name is Jerry Aker. I work with Heifer Project International. That's right, Heifer. And that is as in young cow. A lot of people in this more increasingly urbanized country we're finding have never heard of the word heifer. Does anybody here doesn't know what a heifer is? Right. I'm not going to talk too much about Heifer Project International, although I do have planned a session next week. Although if anybody's interested in learning more about what we do, I'd be I'm around and we can talk, and I'll interject it into some of the sessions as examples as well.
Do you know Justice Cameron Manona?
Yeah. He's in Manona. You from Iowa?
I'm from Manona.
Oh, okay. The reason that I can talk, claim to have some credibility in talking about Central America, I'll just tell a little bit about myself, and then I want to get into a little bit of your awareness of Central America. I work present time as the program director for Latin America and the Caribbean for HPI, Heifer Project International, and we work in projects which specialize in livestock in quite a number of countries in that region. The organization works worldwide, but I focus on Latin America and the Caribbean. I travel to Central America 2 or 3 times a year, although I have a large territory to cover, which includes the Andean region of South America all the way down to Chile, Haiti, Dominican Republic, the Eastern Caribbean, and Mexico. So it's a little bit of chunk of real estate to try to cover in the course of a year, and I like to visit most of the projects that we visit, that we support. That brings me into contact primarily with church-related organizations, private organizations of campesinos, of farmers, and primarily of rural poor people, which is the target that we try to help. Previous to that, I've been doing this for about 7 years. Previous to that, my wife and I and our family lived in Central America, starting in right after the great earthquake that hit Managua at Christmas of 1972. We had just come from 3 years in Peru, working with the LCA, the Lutheran Church in America Mission Board, and just at that time the earthquake hit. And we were asked to go by Lutheran World Relief and Church World Service to mount a program there, which was supposed to be a temporary kind of involvement, and ended up being one of the most challenging and rewarding experiences of our lives. So we spent, rather than going there for 2 months, we spent 2.5 years, and then we finally took a furlough and we went back. We lived in Nicaragua, then that first term and also went back to Nicaragua from 76 to 78. We did live a short time in Honduras and have traveled extensively in Guatemala and the other countries. Have less experience, direct experience with El Salvador in terms of the last year or two. We don't have any work in Heifer Project in El Salvador. However, in my work with the Lutherans, previously with Lutheran World Relief, I was working and traveling and doing a lot with regard to El Salvador up till about a year and a half or so ago. Well, that's a little bit about myself. I wanted to go back to this concept or this word that I've been thinking about today a lot after Elmer mentioned it last night, aware, being aware. You were all at the Eucharist service last night, and he was talking about it in terms of awareness of ourselves with other people. And that strikes me that we as Americans, we as Christians, should be should work on our awareness, perhaps, about Central America, particularly as we relate to the poor and the Christian communities of Central America. My assumptions about you is that perhaps there's more awareness in this group than in the general population of the United States, although I may be wrong. I would assume that some of you have a very dim understanding, or a very vague understanding of the problems in Central America, and that's to be expected in our the kind of information and news media that's handling that we are submitted to every day. Some of you perhaps are deeply involved in Central America or are very concerned about Central America. I guess that in this group there might have been some that have even visited there. But I think it's important that we start at that point. What I was thinking about after today, after Elmer talked about that a little bit last night, I started my thinking that I'm going to use some terms that are commonly used or have been used in Latin America in the last several years in the whole area of what they call popular education, of consciousness raising, and the growth and the church as a social change institution and as an institution which people relate to for finding meaning for their lives. There's a tremendous wealth of experience that's coming out of the Latin American church. Well, one of these concepts, I think, is that of awareness. And I was thinking about what are the component parts of awareness. If you're aware of something, what has to have happened in you to have that status?
Informed.
Information, yeah.
Some knowledge.
Information or knowledge. And what else?
Exposure.
Pardon?
Exposure.
Exposure, good. Or experience. And it probably comes out of also maybe our values, our interests. Maybe sometimes we're just naturally interested. But primarily it's probably information and knowledge that we somehow have gotten about Central America and some kind of experience. And unfortunately for most of us, we don't have the opportunity to have direct experience with Central Americans, although some of you may have. What that leads us to, I think, is, and this is a very imperfect model, I'm just sort of playing around here with concerns and maybe the need or the desire for more information or more experience. But there's something else that I don't want to leave out, which I find just amazingly sort of in the air when we get involved in the issues of Central America, and that is our feelings. I can go and talk to a group, and I think it wouldn't be very difficult to get a debate going Oftentimes, however, when I go and talk to a group of people that may invite me to talk to them about Central America, I find that I'm already talking to the converted, so to speak. People that are already pretty aware, pretty concerned about Central America, have high commitment to some issues about Central America, if that, whatever that might be. But the bottom line then leads us to, what are we going to do? Action. What to do? It's quite probable that some of you have already got so much information and you're so saturated that you're frustrated with it. You don't know what to do. And I think that's a common experience in some American church people, some people of faith. They're oversaturated, they're over-stimulated with the challenge out of this information, out of this experience, out of their own values and desire to do something and their concerns and their feelings, what to do about it. So, I said that I wanted to get into some kind of way of getting in touch with what level of awareness we might be in this group. So I'm going to try something, which is a little technique, and so we're going to go through it for several minutes, of sort of guided imagery. Trying to get you to be in touch with your awareness of Central America. And the way we're going to do that is just simply to ask you to be comfortable in your chair, maybe put your feet flat on the floor. Or if you're really comfortable, it's kind of hard for you to do that in your bellies up there. You might lay on your backs or close your eyes at least. Let's just take a couple of minutes and close your eyes. Just take a couple of deep breaths so you get comfortable and centered down for a minute. Then I'm going to ask you to go and let the awareness sort of float around about Central America in you and see if you can go back to pick up what your first awareness of Central America was. It may go back a long way for some of you or recently for others. It may be a face, maybe something you read, something you saw on television. Sort of be aware of that and then get in touch with the feeling that is associated with that awareness. Try to intensify that feeling a little bit. It may be very dim for some of you because you have not had the chance to be aware of Central America. And then just move along and be aware now of your present feelings about Central America. What is the strong dominant feeling or feelings there? Are there any people involved? Are there any relationships? Are there any concerns? And that may lead you into a prayer. Now I just ask you to open your eyes as you feel that you're ready, and then maybe we'll share a little bit about this. If you wish to give me some feedback about both of these concerns and feelings, let's see if any of you would be willing to share some words or descriptive phrases on these two levels. Anybody have any concerns? About Central America? Or is your awareness fairly vague about the region, about the people, about the issues?
About social injustice.
Social injustice is certainly.
Military actions.
Military actions. Any other?
Up here, kind of with that one, the way our government seems to militarize the social problem.
Military?
The economic problem.
Yeah. Militarization of a economic or social problem.
One of my concerns is to who's really telling the truth about what's happening down there. I keep hearing conflicting stories between what the government says and what some of the other, say, church organizations have.
What's the truth? Good question. Good concern. I'm glad you came here because I can tell you. Any other concerns that
they're feeling toward us, too, the way they feel toward us?
Their feelings toward us. Good.
One major concern I have is what is allowable for national self-determination in a world that's bipolar.
Self-determination and polarization, is that what you mean?
Polarization, yeah.
Right.
The word that occurs to me that relates to our church is a sanctuary.
Sanctuary. I may not be spelling all of these right. Are you all familiar with the term sanctuary? I think we have a pretty aware group here. Well, these are some of them I would have expected, and I'm glad to see them come out. I often deal with this question. What's the truth? I think this is a fairly highly sensitive, I mean, it indicates a sensitive awareness of, or at least concern. What are they feeling toward us? How can you get to what Central American people think or feel, particularly as it relates to us? What about feelings? We've been talking kind of head stuff here, you know, questions, our need for information.
Frustration.
Yeah. Frustration.
Frustration.
Anybody want to say any more about frustration? Why are you frustrated?
Because you don't know the truth or how they answer.
You don't know the truth, it's hard to discern.
Extremely difficult questions.
There's a lot of very difficult, complicated questions.
There's a feeling of fear, too.
Guilt? Is that what you said?
Fear and guilt. Fear and guilt.
Mm-hmm. Anger.
What's the fear connected with?
Well, fear of being down there and what could happen.
Okay, fear of what could happen.
Yeah.
Our involvement, mm-hmm. Our government, our people, our country.
Another aspect is the thought that who are we to be determining what happens in that country? It's not our country. We're not the same culture, the same background.
Okay, what is the feeling connected with that thought?
We're sort of violating our right. I mean, we're violating their rights.
We're not being sort of true to our own democratic principles, maybe.
And a feeling of mistrust, I think, of our own government.
Mistrust.
Disappointment.
Disappointment. I want to take it one step farther before I talk a little bit about some ideas on this. What have some of you thought about doing about it? Or what are some of you doing? You know, if we start down this path in Central America, it's just an amazing thing in the last 5 years. I've observed it with people that get involved in Central America. It's a risky thing. Because you kind of get really involved And I've seen that particularly with the tour groups that go down and go to Nicaragua, Mexico, El Salvador. And there are a lot of Lutherans that have done that, and a lot of other denominations. It's just a phenomenal thing. I never go on these tours, but every time I'm in Nicaragua, sometimes in Honduras and El Salvador, you find groups of Americans now. It's really a different phenomenon than the Vietnam War situation, where people had these similar kind of questions, similar kind of feelings, but people now are going down to see, trying to find out for themselves. The bishops of the American Lutheran Church, how many of them? About 19 of them made a trip there last year. They came out with a fairly strong sort of statement on that. Constituency from a lot of the districts and synods have gone.
What's your feeling on these tourists, good or bad, as far as relations?
Okay, that's a good question too. What is the feeling about, does it do any good? Well, the whole, you know, sort of the bottom line is awareness building.
Are they in danger?
Awareness. The reason for tour groups to go there, the reason for getting involved in Central America, partially, is to get more information, to make up your own mind, to get a lot of experience, to get exposure, to get in touch with Central Americans. It's really frustrating to deal with the issue on an abstract level.
Everybody, my question is, are they letting you see what you should see, or yeah, are they being...
Well, there's an interesting, in the Lutheran magazine, a couple of months ago, Trexler, I don't know if any of you get the LCA publication, but wrote an editorial on that question, and he said, it seems like you can trust the opinions of people that come back from there, because a group from Kansas goes down, a group from Wisconsin goes, and a group from Florida, and oftentimes the results, their sort of opinions, are very similar when they come back. And they do have a wide variety of contacts and so forth when they go to Central America. The next month in the Lutheran, the letters to the editor were pro and con to that, and they said, well, you know, it's kind of the Marxist whitewash job that you get there. When you go to Nicaragua, they were referring to that. And on the other hand, there was some that sort of supported that point of view. I think my personal opinion is very valuable. I feel that it can be a burden on the Nicaraguans, in some cases, and the Salvadorans. We're trying to do a job. What Americans often do is to go there and get this experience. And the Central Americans, the number one thing they say consistently is, take what you see, what you hear, what you feel, take it back home and tell them back there. Try to change policy. Try to enlighten and educate. That's the bottom line. And so I've asked Central Americans, well, is this a valuable thing? It just takes away from your work. I know some people that work in refugee work, that work in development projects, and work in rural agricultural projects and so forth. I mean, they're running tour businesses, they're running Americans around, and it isn't a healthy thing when American groups, large groups, go and visit a village, for instance. You know, the villagers are sitting there, wow, what are we going to do with all these gringos? But that has been a very, I think that's been seen as a very positive experience. I'd say there are thousands of Americans now that have visited Central America. I don't know the numbers, but within the Lutheran thing that's run out of Augsburg College, I think it's something like 25 groups a year last year. These are groups. By the way, I have a copy of the statement that was written by the group of 22 that went from this area, from Washington, Oregon. Signed by all, by 21 of them. These ranged in age from 18 to 60 or something like that. And contrasting the feelings that they got out of going to Salvador and then to Nicaragua. And I have about 20 copies here if anybody's interested in picking one of those up, because I think it's very indicative of the kind of experience that Americans are having as they go and travel down there. Okay. So that's one of the things that people do, is to go and see. What have any of the, have you contemplated any other kind of actions, involvements? I know one person here that was contemplating something. Where is she? What?
Are you looking for me?
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking about going down there and working for a year as a nurse.
I think that's another step, trying to make a contribution, going there and living with the people.
Someone else mentioned the sanctuary.
Sanctuary movement in this country, and that's the closest thing perhaps we have to do that has to do with really a real risk-taking step of involvement when people get committed to and understand what's happening in Central America, which is causing a tremendous exodus from El Salvador and Guatemala, particularly, of people into this country, which come in as illegal aliens. And what is our Christian responsibility to that? And some of you have dealt with that a lot, perhaps, in discussions. Well, that whole area of concern and the feelings, and I really empathize with this one of frustration. You know, the things that we are told that we can do if we really get concerned, the more you get concerned and the more you do it, the more it feels like it doesn't have any impact. Because you continue to see the growth of how huge the problem is, how huge the need is, how much the suffering is, how much the displacement, the poverty, the death that's happening. I want to give three little case examples of this thing about awareness and perspectives. I think this place here in Holden is a wonderful place to talk about perspective. What do you have to do when you want to get a perspective on something?
Talk to people.
Well, okay. Well, let's take the analogy of going on your hike, as you did today. You back up and you see the panorama. You see it all out there, if you can. And it's very difficult with regard to Central America. You can't see everything. There are so many things that you have to keep digging. You have to keep talking to people. You have to keep involvement with people and with the issues. But that's a good point. You have to talk to people. But backing away, and that's the thing that I think I want to stress here, and let's look even at this session as a process of awareness that goes to concern, that in which you have to deal with feelings, but on the bottom line, it leads you to some kind of commitment, perhaps, as a Christian. It leads you to some kind of action. If it doesn't, that's all right, because there are a lot of other issues too. I realize and I feel very strongly about Namibia and South Africa, but I can only deal. I'm saturated at the present time with Central America, and I try to do what I can for my concerns for South Africa. But in a sense, you have to pick your issue, your concerns, your commitments too. To get this perspective on the problem in Central America. Take case example number one. About 2 years ago, the president appointed a bipartisan commission on Central America, headed by Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger doesn't know anything about Latin America, but he's a very smart man. He had made a comment about 10 years ago, when Chile was a big issue, and was being visited by some Latin Americans, to the effect that whatever happens in the South is really of no major concern, because the major decisions and the major policies and directions in the world go on an axis between Washington, Moscow, London, Tokyo, maybe Paris, but that east-west kind of mentality. So you can imagine what the Latin American who was going to interview him felt when he said, it is of no concern, really, what happens in the South. It has no real bearing on the issues of power in the world, for instance. Named to that commission were, yes, it was bipartisan. I don't have the list here, and I should have reviewed it since I'm using this case, but my recollection is that there were no women on that commission of some 20. They were almost all academics, some businessmen, a labor leader, ex or present foreign affairs, foreign service, diplomatic types. They did almost all of their research in Washington. They interviewed academics. They sent out questionnaires. They made a trip through Central America. And they talked to top leadership people in all the countries. My recollection is that they didn't talk to one poor person. They didn't talk to anybody in the base Christian communities. They talked, as I remember it, to one victim of the poor. I suspect that they practically had, now this is a prejudice, their report and their opinions formed before they went. But tremendous, you know, public to-do about the Kissinger, the bipartisan commission report. Well, where do they get their perspective? What counts in policy making, in political maneuvering? What counts? Who do you talk to get your information? Who do you listen to about frustration and fear and guilt, particularly fear in Central America? There was some recognition in one of the chapters of the report about the roots of the problem, but really not an understanding from the base. So that's one perspective. Another way of awareness building and arriving at a perspective. When I first went to, we first went, this is my wife Judy, she just gave us, we went to Nicaragua in early 1973, after the earthquake that destroyed Managua. And we started working with the churches there. That was my interest, and I was given that opportunity by Church World Service and by Lutheran World Relief. And we formed an organization. I worked with the leadership of the evangelical, and when I use the word evangelical, I mean in the sense of they use it in Latin America. They don't use the term protestante, they use the word evangelico. So the evangelical leaders come, and churches, the pastors, come out of fundamentalist, conservative, theologically, Pentecostal in many cases. But we started working where they were, and we're blessed with the tremendous leadership of the, particularly amongst the Baptists in Nicaragua, and formed an organization called CEPAD, the Evangelical Committee for Development. They started doing relief work, which is a good place to start after you've had an earthquake. They started doing then some community development work and services to children and health and cooperatives, all kinds of sort of traditional approaches to change, to social and economic change. Coming along through the 70s, I can remember very distinctly the oppression starting to build as things started to bubble up from underneath, as the Sandinista movement got more converts to it, as the guerrillas became stronger in the hills, as Christian communities and Christian leadership in communities started to question and to talk about things like human rights. And the pastors who formed the directorate, or the board of directors of CEPAD, of these 30 or 35 evangelical churches, We're always reflecting on the Bible, out of the Bible, in the context of what was happening in the society. And they were blessed by a tremendous leader, Gustavo Parajon, who is a medical doctor but knew as much about the Bible as any man I've ever met. And in the assemblies, in the general assemblies of CEPAD, they would spend more time in reflecting on the Bible than they would on business. And so the whole church started, because of that, to raise an awareness. And in about the mid-70s, I can remember very distinctly a meeting of the board of directors when the oppression started really strongly in the hills. A little Pentecostal pastor came and talked to his denominational head, and that person brought him to the board of directors of CEPAD, these pastors, who've been struggling and discussing what do we do in an oppressive situation. And he told a story. I think this is something we have to remember, that telling a story about what happens to people is a very important part of justice education there and here, and awareness building. He told the story of what had happened to him. And when he took his shirt off and he showed the torture marks on his back, it was at that point that those pastors, the board of directors, realized that they weren't in a theological or at least a theoretical discussion. They couldn't talk about not becoming involved in politics. They couldn't talk about whether or not they should make a statement on human rights. They had been engaged at that point in the reality of what was going on in the country. That was an awareness building then that grew, and so that in that case the churches were with the people. They were of the people, in most cases, of the evangelical churches in Nicaragua and in Central America. They are churches of the poor. Another case example. 2 years ago, I was visiting El Salvador, and I visited a cooperative called La Florida. It had been worked with for about 4 years by the Episcopal Church. And I visited, there was about 60 or 65 families, and they had done a tremendous job, and they were producing, and they had built houses, and they had land, and they were producing vegetables and some sugar cane. And they were talking to us about their next step, which was to put in a dairy so they could get milk for their children. Well, I realized that technically they needed some help, and we had a lot of going back and forth, and there's a lot of involvement with planning, and it's such a complicated project. And this went on for some months. And the next, one of the last communications I got about the cooperative of La Florida was that on the night of December 7th, I believe it was, 2 years ago, about 60, a contingent of about 60 of the army had come into their cooperative. It had always been fairly peaceful in that part of the country, and called out the leaders and interrogated them, sort of terrorized the community that night. And before the dawn broke the next morning, 8 of the men had their throats slit, and they were laying on the street in front of the houses, leaving behind 8 widows and 25 children. Well, that destroyed that cooperative, and that was perhaps the purpose of whoever put those soldiers up to that. About a year later, a friend of mine was visiting in the Lutheran refugee camp, Fe y Esperanza, Faith and Hope, which is run by the Lutheran Synod of El Salvador. And he happened to be talking to 3 women. And he found out that these 3 women were from that cooperative. They had been in that cooperative. I don't remember if it had been their husbands that had been killed. But after he established some confidence with these 3 women, he asked them then what had happened. What happened to the people after that night of terror that they experienced? And he found out that some of them were in refugee camps. They were completely dependent now on aid from the outside. But many of them had gone into the hills to take up arms and to fight against oppression in that way. My judgment would be that perhaps that or my, I guess, rational analysis of that would be that that would not be the way that I would do it. How can I judge people who have gone through that kind of experience? To make that decision, which is a bottom line decision, which may bring them death. That is another kind of awareness building. It's a rather dramatic example. But awareness, conscientization, or consciousness raising, has been happening going back to the late 60s and throughout the 70s, throughout Central America. And a lot of it has to do with Christian groups getting together and reflecting on the Bible in the context of their realidad, their reality. Very popular term in Latin America, reflexionar sobre la realidad, reflect on your reality. And it's harder for us to empathize with that, I suppose, because we don't suffer, usually. We don't have a family member that disappears in the middle of the night. We're not immersed in that depth of conflict or struggle. Any comments now or questions that I'd like to be more aware of as I prepare for the rest of this week, for you or for others that may want to come? And any comments on what I've said or reflections that you might
have? You said you work with Lutheran World Relief. Are they still there, or have they gone on since the earthquake things were straightened out on the net?
Well, the Lutheran World Relief continues to be a very good program of support for local organizations of the churches in most of those countries, particularly where the greatest need is. And I did continue to work with them up until 2 years ago on a part-time basis. And I'm still very much in touch with them, and I feel that if you support Lutheran World Relief, you're doing a good... That's
well,
one good
I have
thing.
Urged that in a lot of different group meetings, to send it to Lutheran World Relief, because I know of their track record, how little is used for overhead and how much goes for actual. And I know I've worked with Lutheran World Relief through awareness programs through Luther College for a little while. And the Catholic Church was funding millions of their dollars at that time through Lutheran World Relief because they did such an excellent job.
I think you're right.
I hope you'll deal with the question of how do you handle the vested interests of the institution, the establishment, and such things as the church, and the military, and the state. They are an example of the Episcopal cooperative. I mean, beautiful illustration of how futile and frustrating activity, however noble, can be if it cannot deal with these power blocks. Yeah. And I wonder if there is any real answer there that is a feasible and practical approach to that.
It's a good question for reflection. I don't have the answer, so maybe that can come out of this group too. Let me ask you a question. I'll give you another example. Heifer Project worked in Guatemala during the 70s, a decade of good work, with about 35 cattle cooperatives in the area called Ixcan, the northern jungle area of Guatemala. We evaluated that program in about 1978, found it was working very well, people were benefiting, people were organized, needed very little supervision from the outside, it was so isolated. But people were taking responsibility and working for themselves. In that same area, we're working with honeybee production cooperatives. The oppression and repression really began very strongly in Guatemala in about 1979. In 1979 and 1980, many, many leaders of cooperatives, of unions, priests, campesino organizations were killed. Every one of those cattle cooperatives was destroyed. So, was it worth doing? Should we continue to work in the face of that kind of odds?
And who destroyed them?
Yes.
Well, in most cases, the army.
But if you don't, then you need a retirement.
If you don't,
If you don't, then you will leave those people with nothing.
Well, in that case, we are completely out of touch with those people. They've scattered. They're refugees in southern Mexico, or they're scattered in the forests of Guatemala, or they're in the slums of the big cities. It's a tough question, and I pose that to you with no answer to give you, because I guess my answer, the closest thing that I have, is that even though it's impossible to achieve the mission, we still have to do it.
Now, who was in control of the army at that time?
Well, the generals have always been in control of Guatemala since 1954.
Somebody? Were the cooperative leaders a threat for the reason of economics being poor, or that they were organized and had communication networks?
The population pressure is so great in the highlands of Guatemala that they have no other choice as each succeeding generation comes along to either divide these small farmers, divide up their plots into smaller and smaller acreages, so that my son would get, of my 5 acres, he would get, if I had 2 sons, they would each get 2.5 acres. It gets to be impossible to make a living after a while. There's no more good land, and most of the good land on the coast is owned by the large sugar plantations. So they immigrated into the jungle, and they did this over on their own. It's the best, it's the toughest, it's the most courageous, the most self-reliant of the campesinos in the highlands that went in there over the years of the 70s, with help of priests, with help of cooperatives and so forth. That particular area that I'm talking about also is reputed to have oil. And the generals, seeing that this great expanse of jungle land, which was not really anybody's property, but could be settled by organized groups of campesinos, was a threat to them, because they wanted to stake out large pieces of land for cattle growing, cattle raising, which could eventually maybe benefit them if a road was put through there, or if oil was discovered in larger amounts in that area. The odds are very bad in many places that we work. It may sound foolhardy, but I think that is what I just said about the odds being, even though the odds are very, very difficult in some cases, and the mission may seem almost impossible. No goal is really worth working for if it is totally possible to achieve. We have to set our goals way out there. The other thing about that is that every time I visited Guatemala in the last 3 years or 4 years since then, I've asked the people that we work with, how can you continue to work? Why do you keep being organized? Why do you ask us for help when that may endanger your very lives? And I said, it's the only thing we can do. We need solidarity with each other more now than ever before. And so they've stuck together. Almost all expatriates, all Americans have left. Very few tourists anymore. Not even any hippies around. And so the Guatemalans are on their own. And they really appreciate the solidarity that the churches and organizations like Heifer Project can give them.
I'd like to ask a question. What about the effectiveness of the medical help from this country in Guatemala? We have a doctor that has a project there and has worked among the Guatemalans for a number of years, Dr. Hugo Sal, you may possibly run across him. And he's doing some sort of a research project at this time, and he's there right now. And didn't take his family because of the political situation. However, they have lived there at one time for 3 or 4 years. And
some of the best grassroots medical work, health work, and Judy could talk a little bit more about that if we had time, has happened in Guatemala. It's really a prototype of things that have been copied in other countries. And I think much of it continues.
Now, is the army supported by the United States, or is it?
Well, not to the extent, to a large extent that it has been in El Salvador or Honduras, but during the Carter administration, because of gross human rights violations, military assistance was cut off to Guatemala. It is only in this year, right now, and it's a very critical time, that the proposal is to reinitiate military assistance to Guatemala. And I think some assistance has been reinitiated.
Would that help the army, or would that?
It would help the army, definitely.
What?
It would help the army.
And destroy the Heifer project and what we're doing.
You got it.
What about, you mentioned that Americans had left there, but you didn't mean American business interests, did you?
Well, I'm not sure how many American businessmen have left.
No, but I mean, as far as a lot of the sugar and...
Guatemala, as a country, had more transnational and North American investment than most of the other countries in Central America. And they did invest in plants in Guatemala City. Guatemala City has been relatively secure. And so some of those businesses have been able to continue. But when I'm talking about the Americans, I'm talking about colleagues like our Heifer Project representative, which we pulled out when he got a threat from the secret anti-communist army, that maybe he would be good for his health if he left.
But who are the large landowners as far as plantations?
I'd say mostly Guatemalans. I want to wrap this up, and I want to do that by talking about another way of getting perspective. Oh, I have to do this too. I have information and more information. Very quickly, I have packets from the Mennonite Central Committee on Central America. Anybody that may have anything to do with educating or wanting to talk to other people about Central America, you can have a copy of this. I have about 20 or 25 copies of this. I have a packet from the American Friends Service Committee, a few of them, Options for Peace in Central America. I've got some other journals and things that come out of Latin America and Central America on a regular basis. I'll put these into the reading room, is that what it's called? Coming out of the Latin American press, a lot of articles on liberation theology, out of the experience of Latin America, a new way of being church. Interreligious Task Force in Central America, update out of the Washington office on Latin America. Christianity in Crisis just had a special issue, a very good issue, on Central America in July. I'll put this in the reading room as well. Mesoamerica, if anybody's interested in the subscription of these kind of things, they'll be over there. And a monthly update on Central America by country. Latin American Press keeps me up to date. It's the best thing if anybody interested in keeping up to date on Latin America, and several other things by country, Guatemala and Nicaragua. Some books. The Word Remains, The Life of Oscar Romero. It's really a good book on the life, on his, what he stood for. Inevitable Revolutions, these are in the bookstore. Inevitable Revolutions, if you want to get a more in-depth understanding historically, this is probably the best historical treatment by an historian, Walter Lefebvre, of the relationship to the United States and Central America, going way back. What's Wrong in Central America and What to Do About It by Phil Berryman, a very good scholar, but a good practitioner, and keeps up. He's works quite a bit with the American Friends Service Committee. That's also in the bookstore. Unexpected News. For a layman like myself, this is the best kind of Bible study approach to understanding liberation theology. I think it's a fascinating, well-done thing, and I'm going to use it on, I think it's Thursday, when we deal with that subject. Reading the Bible with Third World Eyes. And if you want a book that'll grip you and read like a hair-raising true story, adventure story, Witness to War by Charles Clemens, it's in the bookstore also. And Charles Clemens was a doctor who went into El Salvador, into the liberated area for about a year, served the civilian population in the liberated zones for that time, and really gives you a feeling what people are going through at that level. I mean, the Salvadoran people, what they're suffering in El Salvador. This is an excellent book. I don't know if we have time for one more thing. Another way to get perspective is through poetry and reading. And I asked Judy to read, as we close, a piece by Julia Esquivel. Judy, we have to come over here. Julia Esquivel is a Guatemalan woman, theologian, and poet, and in exile now. But she writes some good things to give us perspective from the point of view of the suffering poor in Guatemala.
This comes out of Threatened with Resurrection, and it's in Spanish and in English, so if you want to brush up on your Spanish. This is titled, Los que vieron la estrella, those who saw the star. The word, for our sake, became poverty, clothed as the poor who live off the refuse heap. The word, for our sake, became agony in the sunken breast of a woman, grown old by the absence of her murdered husband. The word, for our sake, became a sob 1,000 times stifled in the immovable mouth of a child who died from hunger. The word, for our sake, became rebellion before the lifeless body of Casper Sanchez Toma, scientifically murdered. The word, for our sake, became danger in the anguish of the mother who worries about her son growing into manhood. The word became an ever-present absence among the 70,000 families torn apart by death. The word, for our sake, became an inexorable accusation arising from the blazing craters which swallowed up their tortured bodies. The word knife cut as deeply in that place of shame, the painful reality of the poor. The word blew its spirit over the dried bones of the mummified churches, guardians of silence. The word, that early morning bugle, awoke us from the lethargy which had robbed us of our hope.
Thank you.